Exodus, the second book in the Bible, so we're going to start there in a moment. Exodus chapter 1, we are starting a brand new Christmas series today. It's a little different. A lot of times we just take a text and kind of walk through it. We're going to kind of do an overview of the Christmas story in a unique way for the next few weeks. But we just saw a clip from a very famous Christmas movie about Christmas trees and the cutting down of a Christmas tree, even if you forget your saw. How many of you already have your Christmas decorations up? How many of you don't have them up yet? Get to work! What? So Christmas decorations are up. There's two types of people when it comes to Christmas decorations up. There are those who decorate after Thanksgiving, and then there are crazy people. And so we are the decorate after Thanksgiving people. And so what I want to give you permission today is if you decorate after Thanksgiving, like the normal people do, if you decorate after Thanksgiving, I want to give you permission to be all in with Christmas after Thanksgiving. And so there's different types of people when it comes to Christmas. There are Buddy the Elf people that get all excited about Christmas. If you don't know who Buddy the Elf is, then you're not on that end of the scale, I can tell you. Buddy the Elf people, and then there are Grinch people, okay? So how many of you would say you're more on the getting really excited about Christmas, Buddy the Elf side of things? How many of you are more on the Grinch side of things? Why is it 90% males who are on the Grinch side of things? So we're going to do a little test to see where you're at on the scale. If Buddy the Elf is a 10 or above and the Grinch is a 1, this is a test to kind of decide where you're at. How many of you, if you are a parent and have kids, do Elf on the Shelf? Okay, that puts you down kind of on the Buddy the Elf, whether you want to be. How many of you don't even know what Elf on the Shelf is? That puts you down on the Grinch side. We were going to do Buddy the Elf, but I got disqualified because I thought it would be a great idea when the kids came in if Buddy the Elf was sitting there in a pair of scissors laying beside him holding his own head. Like, I think that's awesome. But that kind of disqualified me. Or Buddy just had one really bad night and then he was done, right? So Elf the Shelf kind of people. If you want to find some entertainment, Google like funny Elf on the Shelf poses. Be careful when you Google it, but Google that and you can find some really funny Elf on the Shelf opportunities. How about when it comes to Christmas lights? Okay, so I'm okay with kind of lights in the house and on the tree. How many of you are outside the house Christmas lights kind of people? Okay, my wife so desperately wants me to be an outside of the house lights kind of person, and I so desperately do not want to be that person. I was for the first 2 years we were married, and then I got kind of past the honeymoon stage, and I'm like, it's just not worth it at this point. I'm not outside the lights. One of my favorite clips from another clip of the movie we saw was when Clark hands the giant ball of Christmas lights to Rusty. He's like, go untangle these, because that's kind of how I feel with the whole outside the lights. Now, this is different level. How many of you are giant inflatables in your yard Christmas people? Like, you've got a giant Santa or something. So that puts you way down here on the Buddy the Elf side of things. I would do the test, like, how many of you leave your Christmas lights up all year? But that's more of a redneck test instead of a where you're at on the scale test. What about Christmas movies? I'm going to give you your opportunity to yell out your favorite Christmas movie when I say three. Okay, one, two, three. I didn't hear any of those, except I heard Die Hard. That doesn't count. But so how many of you watch your favorite Christmas movie more than one time every year? Okay, how many of you watch it 5 times in 1 year? That's a lot. I put you way down on the Buddy the Elf side of the scale. But what if your favorite movie's The Grinch? Where does that put you on the scale? I guess it puts you on this end because he ends up with a changed heart. Now, around my house, we love Christmas, not in a crazy kind of way, but in a fun kind of way. My kids, my older three kids, not Levi, but my older three, they're now young adults, approaching young adults. If you were to talk to them, they would tell you that back in the day, I robbed them of the spirit of Christmas. Because I would not lie to them. I'm an honest, ethical dad. When they ask me, no clapping, because I'm going to get, because there's the rest of the story in a moment. I wouldn't lie to them that some dude slid down the chimney and left gifts for them. I mainly didn't lie to them because we were never at our house on Christmas. We were always at the grandparents, so there had to be some explanation about the whole Christmas thing. And I knew Santa was going to show up at the grandparents, but I refused, and my conscience is the excuse I used, that I'm not going to lie to them about Santa. Really, I just didn't want Santa getting the credit for like all the hard work I put into having to buy the gifts and put those suckers together. Like, he's not getting credit for that. And now my kids feel like that I took from them, that I robbed from them, that they don't have the same Christmas spirit as all their friends, because I wouldn't lie to my kids. Where are we at on this? You guys on my side on this, right? So the rest of the story, though, is like, hello, Levi's having Santa Claus. Because I've kind of let up a little bit at this point, so I'm okay. No, I'm just kidding. So, like, Santa for me is in the same category as, I don't know, Buzz Lightyear and Woody. They're fun. He's fun, and he's a fictional character and all that. But that dude's not getting credit for my hard work, I can tell you. So, don't talk to my kids about this conversation. So, we have fun at Christmas, but not in a crazy kind of way. Reagan, are you over your bitterness at this point? Still not over it. So I have to admit, Christmas is not perfect around our house. There's a vast gap between what the commercials promise and reality. Christmas propaganda leads us to believe otherwise, doesn't it? That everything's going to be perfect. That's what the commercials, the Christmas movies, the TV ads tell us, that miracles will happen, that there will be no fighting during the Christmas season, that there'll be no weight gain, no matter what you eat. And I can tell you that's not true, just from Thanksgiving. That there's not going to be any annoyance on Christmas Day. Everybody's going to get along great. Your crazy redneck family is going to behave during Christmas. That's what the commercials tell us. That the kids are going to get up and open their presents with excitement. And there's going to be lights everywhere and a gleam in their eye. And they're going to be excited about every gift they get. They're going to show deep gratitude and appreciation. They're going to play with it longer than 5 minutes. They're going to play with the toy longer than the box. Like, that's what the commercials tell us. But that's not reality. Commercials tell us that after Christmas morning and the opening, that the wives are going to look at their husbands and say, you bought me the perfect gift. How do you know me so well? You must be deeply in love with me to know, without me telling you or even dropping a hint, that you could buy the perfect gift for me. That's what the commercials tell us. That's what the propaganda tells us. Frosty doesn't melt. The angel gets his wings. Scrooge provides, I don't know, universal health care for Tiny Tim. Like, that's what the commercials tell us. And I'm here to tell you, it's not going to happen. That's not reality. That the Christmas propaganda is fake news. That the commercials overpromise. But let me hesitate to say this. Maybe the commercials underpromise. Because in this series, what we'll discover is that the Christmas story is actually better than you even realize. That things are not perfect, and they have not been perfect since that very first Christmas morning. But one day, they will be perfect because of the story we find within Christmas. Because the Christmas story tells us who God is, what God is like, and what God's been up to, and that the Christmas story is not limited to a 6-pound, 5-ounce baby in a barn in a feeding trough. The story actually starts much earlier than what is portrayed on your mantle in your nativity scenes. The first Christmas was actually the climax of a story that began thousands of years earlier. A story God had been preparing the world for since he breathed breath into Adam. If you're like me, when you are a brand new parent, there's a lot of preparation that goes into being a new parent, particularly your very first child. So if you kind of know my story, I kind of have three that are older, and then Levi came along some, I don't know, seems like 35 years later. But Levi comes along, and so I kind of went through the new parent thing twice. I kind of had three close together, and then Levi. And I remember those feelings of being a new parent and preparing for that child, right? Like you got to get everything right. You got the bed and the diapers and the clothes and the blankets and the medication and the baby monitor so you can watch them every minute of every day. Now you even have like a place you can put bad diapers that don't stink. Like you do all this stuff to prepare for the baby. You prepare for everything except for how to parent a newborn. Like I just have to learn that from experience. But preparation, tons of preparation. Did you know the first two-thirds of the Bible reminds us of how God prepared humanity for the birth of his son? It's a story that started in Genesis. Now we're going to jump in about, I don't know, 1,400, 1,500 years prior to this historic supernatural night in Bethlehem that we call the Christmas story. We're going to jump into the middle of the story in the book of Exodus, and then we're going to bounce to the New Testament to see how this is fulfilled later on. But in our story, God's people, the Israelites, if you're a Bible person or even a kind of not a big Bible person, you probably heard the story of the Israelites. They were God's people, and they find themselves enslaved. Not only enslaved, but oppressed by one of the world's superpowers, a country named Egypt at that time, run by a king named Pharaoh. Now, that's a story within a story that we don't have time for, how they ended up in Egypt under Pharaoh. Now, it was very common in that era to be enslaved or oppressed by one of the world's superpowers, but it was very hard for God's chosen people because he had made a previous promise to their great-great-granddaddy Abraham that he would love them, help them, bless them, that they were a chosen people, and not only would he love and care for and bless them, but the entire world would be loved, cared for, and blessed because of them. And yet, here's where we find them. Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Again, that's kind of the story within the story we don't have time for. Verse 9, this new king said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they'll join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses, that was his sons. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. So again, here's the Israelites living in Egypt. The king gets freaked out because the Israelites are multiplying rapidly, and he basically says, look, at some point if a war breaks out, we are way outnumbered. So we're going to make them slaves, and they began to deal very harshly with them. So things are really, really bad and difficult, and then things got worse. As a matter of fact, things got horrific. Look at verse 22. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." Pharaoh reaches a point where he says, every newborn son, throw him in the river. We're going to kill the newborns. So think about God's people, oppressed, struggling, afflicted, enslaved, hopeless, abused, helpless. And you identify with where they're at in some way? I think all of us that have kind of lived life in this broken world at different stages in life and maybe where you're at right now, like we can identify with those feelings. Oppressed, struggling, hurting, hopeless, helpless. Now, when the Christmas season hits, and you kind of get beyond the lights and the tinsel and the decorations and the mantle manger scene and the presents under the tree, like when you kind of get beyond the surface level of Christmas, and reality is there are a lot of people who are struggling, and they're struggling deeply. And maybe you're here today and you're one of those. You're struggling. Maybe you're struggling for something going on in your life. Maybe you're struggling with the people that are in your life. Maybe you're struggling with some sin that's in your life. Maybe you are struggling with some type of regret that's in your life. It seems like a lot of times the Christmas season brings those things out at a heightened level, some type of flaw, some type of regret, some type of mistake that you've made in your past. Maybe you are struggling with your history, your story. Maybe you're struggling with where you've been. Maybe you're struggling with like expectations, like everybody else's expectations. Maybe you're struggling with your own expectations. Like, I didn't think I would be here in life. I didn't think I would be this age and dealing with this in my life. I didn't think I would be in this season at this age in my life. I thought I would be here, but instead I'm here. Maybe you're just struggling with finances, with money, like how am I going to pay for Christmas, and my kids aren't going to get enough or have enough, or the, again, kind of the expectation level. And so all of us kind of find ourselves relating to or identifying, maybe not in the same situation, but with the same kind of emotions that the Israelites were going through when they had a promise from God of these things that were going to be great, they're going to be blessed, and they were going to be God's people, and in their minds, they're going to rule the world, and yet they find themselves oppressed, struggling, wrestling. And then the most horrific of all, their kids being taken from them and killed and slaughtered by Pharaoh. One of the things I love about the story of Christmas is that the story of Christmas is a story of how God enters the mess, how God enters the chaos, how God enters the fray. When his people were struggling and doubtful and rebellious and feeling abandoned, like that's when God enters the picture. And newsflash for all of us, we are a mess. We're a mess. We're a mess because we're sinners. We live in the mess. We live in the sin and the sadness and the frustration and the ups and downs. And if you're like me, there's been those times in my life where I just kind of scratched my head and said, like, where's God in all this? Where is God in this moment? Where is God in this situation? Where is God in this time? And like, that's the baggage and the reality that we bring to the Christmas story, isn't it? Like, we bring that to the Christmas story, that we're bringing our own mess. And we can try and tie it up and put a bow on it and make it appear nice. But to do that is to miss the heart of the Christmas story. Because the heart of the Christmas story is that God enters into the messiness. That God comes down into the chaos. I love these words of hope in Exodus chapter 2 when all of this is going on. Look in verse 23. And during those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned. They groaned because of their slavery, and they cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. So get this picture. The Israelites, they're groaning. And that's an intense word there, like they're struggling, they're hurting. And so they cry out for help. Like, that's the cry of rescue, of help, like, God, where are you? And their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. Now, I love these next words. And God heard. And God heard their groaning. Like, those three words are pivotal, essential words to the story of the mess and the chaos. And God heard their groaning. And God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel. And God, what's that next word? And God knew. He knew. So in the midst of all of this, and the oppression and the struggling, here we have the gospel. Because the gospel is, in all of that, in the craziness and the messiness and the chaos, in all of that, that God hears and God sees and God knows that God is not removed from your life, that God is not distant from you, that God is not ignorant of your situation, that God is not surprised at what's happening to you, that God is not sitting in heaven wringing his hands thinking, what am I going to do? I wasn't expecting that. Like, that's not God. We have a God who sees and hears and knows what you're going through. And here they are, oppressed and struggling, and they cry out to God. And as a matter of fact, in our story and in the Christmas story, not only does God hear and see and know, but God intervenes, doesn't he? He steps into their space. He enters our space. He enters the mess. And in the book of Exodus, he does it in a supernatural way through a guy named Moses. He steps into their mess in a supernatural way, like, let's make a movie with Charlton Heston kind of way, right? Like, God, and by the way, like, has there been any Moses portrayed in movies better than Charlton Heston? Like, that's the ultimate, like, Moses in a movie, right? And so God steps into the mess in this supernatural way, like, make a movie about it kind of way. And so Moses enters into the story. Now, you talk about a crazy intervention story. I'm not talking about like A&E intervention. I'm talking about like a crazy intervention story. Here's a guy that was born an Israelite boy, a Hebrew. We just read about what Pharaoh was doing to the Hebrew boys, throwing them in the river. And so here's this guy that was born a Hebrew, born an Israelite boy. And his mom, to avoid this young man being murdered, this boy being murdered, makes a basket for him and floats him down the very river where Pharaoh's murdering the boys. Like, floats him down the river where kids are being killed. And he's found by none other than Pharaoh's daughter. And she pulls him out of the Nile and names him Moses, which means to bring out. She finds this young boy, and this young Hebrew boy that should have been killed is raised, are you kidding me? Is raised in the palace of the very king who wanted to kill him? Like, God intervenes in crazy supernatural ways. And so here's this Moses that is raised in the very palace of the man who wanted to slaughter him. Until one day, when he's a young man, he looks around and sees one of his boys, one of the Hebrews, one of the Israelites, taking a beating. And he says, enough is enough. And he responds and he kills one of Pharaoh's guards. Now again, the Christmas story is messy. The story of redemption's messy. Here we have a young man raised in the house of Pharaoh that murders, right? And then he tries to cover it up. He hides the body. But the body's discovered. And so here's this young man that flees for his life to the backside of the mountains, to the desert, and becomes a shepherd. Like, who writes this story besides God? Young Hebrew boy, saved from a slaughtering king, floated down a river, found by the Pharaoh's own daughter, raised in the palace, as a young man, murders one of the king's guards because he's beaten up on one of the slaves. The king's irate, find this guy. He runs to the backside of a mountain, living in a desert, serving as a shepherd. Like, this is only a story that a God who intervenes can write. God enters into the story, right? Enter God. Because God hears, God sees, God knows, God intervenes. He enters our space. And so he shows up to Moses on the backside of the mountain in the desert, serving as a shepherd, shows up in a burning bush and says, hey, I've heard my people and I'm going to rescue them. And you are the one who will go. You're going to go. You're going to stand before Pharaoh, and you're going to demand their freedom. And Moses says, I stutter. And God says, I don't. You're going. And then Moses breaks into this long list of excuses why he's not the guy. And God shoots down every excuse until the end. God finally says, look, Moses, I get it. You're a weakling. You're pathetic, but guess what? I'm not. So let's go. Because you're not in charge, I'm in charge. And they need to know who's in charge. And it's not you. It's me, God says. So let's go. Off they go. Show up in Egypt. There's this confrontation between God and Pharaoh. Guess who wins that one? Like, God wins. Sends these plagues, water to blood, frogs, gnats, flies. Like, I'm thinking God should have added ants to this list. Because, like, it's wintertime in the south. And I can tell you, all the ants that live in the Caddo, Alabama area around my house have decided my house is the warm house on the block. So all the ants from the outside are moving to the inside of my house. To the point, don't ask my wife because she's going to exaggerate it way more than the reality. But I will admit that one night we woke up with ants in our bed on our bodies during the night. Now, if you listen to Ashley tell the story, you would think like they were transporting her from my bedroom to one of the kids' rooms. There weren't that many ants. But now you're talking to the guy that's allergic to ants, right? So, like, my life is on the line, which basically is just an excuse for me getting out of trying to figure out where the ants are coming from and killing them. Like, babe, one bite and I'm toast. Like, you want to put my life, do you want to grow up without, do you grow up? Do you want to live? Did I say that? Do you want to live life without a husband? So imagine it's not just ants, but gnats and frogs and lice and sickness and disease and all these things are happening. Again, if you think the Bible is boring, like, go read Exodus. It's not a boring book. And so all of these things happen, sickness and hail from the sky, and it was day and now it's dark. Hello, God's in control until finally the last plague of all, God comes in and he takes the life of firstborns in Egypt because Pharaoh refuses. God intervenes again and again and again. Even the plagues are God's intervention again and again and again to say, I'm God and Pharaoh's not. I am all powerful and he is not. I am sovereign and he is not. Pharaoh, let my people go. And Pharaoh says, go when the plague comes. And then he says, no. And then another plague comes and Pharaoh says, go. And then the plague's over and Pharaoh says, no. So it's this go and no before finally the Red Sea kind of eliminates the final no factor. Like, they're done after the Red Sea. By the way, before we come down too hard on Pharaoh, guess what? We all have Pharaoh living inside of us. Pharaoh lives inside of our hearts. We are idolaters at heart that dig our heels into God and say, I want my way. And it looks a little different than it looked for Pharaoh, but all of us have a Pharaoh living inside of us that digs our heels in and says, no, 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 I want it my way. I want to be in charge of my life. I want to be in control of my life. And we dig our heels into God and we say, no, no, no. And guess what God does? He sees. He hears. He knows. He intervenes. And he sets his people free. You say, Devin, that's awesome. The Exodus story is great. Makes for great movies and Bible storybooks and all those things. But Devin, that's not how I feel. Like, where is God in my brokenness? Where's God in my pain? Where's God in my hurt? Why doesn't God show up in my situation? Why doesn't God intervene in my life? And here's where I want to push us to say, well, maybe he is. Maybe you sitting here this morning is part of God's intervention in your life. Like, maybe we're looking for water that's turned into blood when God is intervening right in front of you in the small ways, in the everyday, in places, in people that he's put in your life. maybe he's intervening just in the breath that is in your lungs. That God is intervening all around us. You see, in this story of God's intervention that we label the Exodus event, the intervention began with God protecting a chosen baby from a murderous king. Does that sound familiar in the Christmas season? As a matter of fact, look at Matthew chapter 2. Let's fast forward to the Christmas story, we call it. Matthew 2, 1 through 3. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." And when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And he kind of goes back and forth with the Magi, jump down to 13. When they had departed, again, this is the Magi, they found Jesus, gave him their gifts, and then they're warned in this dream to go a different direction or not return to Herod. And so, verse 13, we jump back in. Now, when they had departed, this is the Magi, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt." Again, God's writing this story. He's like taking him back to Egypt, like just where they were when Moses brought him out. "Flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to what? To destroy him. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt." Verse 16, "Then Herod, when he saw they had been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent," and what? "And he killed all the male children in Bethlehem in all the region who were 2 years old and under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men." Same thing. Herod murders 2 years and under. That's Levi, by the way. Herod murders 2 years and under. And I want to tell you, like this, the massacre of the innocents is called. The massacre of the innocents doesn't make the Christmas story books. And it doesn't make the mantle. And it's not in the manger scene. But it's part of the story, isn't it? Because it's the mess, and it's the sin, and it's the darkness. And God's chosen people are living under the dominion of this superpower that's now called Rome. And this murderous puppet king named Herod tried to eliminate any threat to his throne by having all the toddler boys slaughtered. It's the Exodus story all over again. It is the story of God responding to people who are crying out to him for hope and deliverance. It is a story of God intervening into human history in a supernatural, and in this case, bigger, better, more complete way. You see, this time God's intervention does not come through a man that he raised up from among the people named Moses. This time, God's intervention comes by God becoming a man, by becoming one of his people, by taking on human flesh. This time, God responds with a better Moses, a final Moses, the Messiah. Listen to what the angel tells Mary, this young virgin who's going to give birth to this extraordinary child in Luke chapter 1. Listen to the angel's words to Mary, Luke 1 verse 31. "And behold," this is the angel talking to Mary, "and behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. And the Lord God will give to him the throne of his father David. And he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. And of his kingdom there will be no end." God is a God who enters into our space. God is not some distant force who created everything to display his supreme powers in the among the other kind of warring deities of his day. God is a relational God, both in his nature as a Trinity and in his desire for relationship with his creation. We sang about it this morning, that his name shall be called Emmanuel, which means God with us, God among us. God enters our space. So listen to me as we start this series. Christmas is not about pretending that we have it all together. It's not about pretending that we don't struggle. It's not about pretending that we do not suffer, that we do not live in the chaos and the mess. Christmas reminds us as we struggle, as we suffer, as we live in the mess, that there is a God who hears and intervenes and who entered into the mess on a rescue mission. You see, when the stakes were eternal, God showed up himself. He didn't leave it up to Moses. When the stakes were eternal, God appeared. God intervened. He didn't send another Moses. And that is how committed God is to our good, to relationship with his creation. And that truth, that part of the Christmas story, changes everything. It changes how we view God, that God is not removed, that God is close, God is near, even when he feels distant, that God is near because he has intervened. He has entered into our space. It changes how we view ourselves. As we, many of you come into Christmas with all of this baggage and questions and uncertainty and doubts and where you're at in life, and as you live in the fray, as you live in the mess, as you live in the chaos, that we know that there is a God who went to the furthest extent, who left heaven and became flesh and entered into our world to intervene in our situation. It lets us know how God views us. That he went to those lengths to have relationship with us. It changes how we view this world that we live in. That yes, it gets messy and it's broken and dysfunctional in so many ways, but there is coming a day when the perfection will arrive. And yes, our Christmas will not be perfect, and it hasn't been perfect, and it will not be perfect as long as we're on this earth, but there is coming a day when God will make all things perfect, when he will restore all. It changes how we view everything. And that, my friend, changes how we celebrate Christmas. So you're here today, and you're thinking, does God even care? Does God hear? Does God intervene? Devin, could God get involved in my life? And you know what the Christmas story says? He already has. He already has. He hears. He sees. He knows. He intervenes. Christmas, it's even better than we realize.